Don't you think you and Kassif might have been better off exploiting the warrant trading on your own instead of publishing the ideas?
I don't think so, because historically, ideas don't just appear in one place. They tend to appear in several places at almost the same time.
Like Newton and Leibniz.
Exactly, or Darwin and Wallace.
When did you start managing money?
It sort of happened on its own while I was at UCI. Both Kassif and I were managing our own accounts. Word got out on campus and people started asking us to manage their money. People who invested were making over 20% per year and they told their friends. Before long, I had a dozen accounts and a lot of happy people on campus.
What was the strategy you were using at the time?
The theme in Beat the Market was that warrants with less than 2 years to run typically traded at premiums that were too high. The typical trade we did was to short the warrant and hedge it by buying the stock.
Delta hedging?
We started out with a static hedge and then decided that dynamic delta hedging was better.
Did you and Kassif manage money together?
No, because we had different ideas of how we believe the strategy should be implemented.
Kassif thought he could tell something about the direction of stock prices and would sometimes take a fundamental view on a stock, whereas I was afraid to do that because I didn't believe I had any forecasting power. I thought we should always hedge to be delta neutral. So we went our separate ways. He and his brother started a managed money business while I managed my individual accounts for a while. When did you develop your own option pricing model?
In 1967, I took some of the ideas about how to price warrants and the random character of stock prices by Paul Kuttner, and thought I could derive a formula if I made the simplifying assumption that all investments grew at the risk-free rate. Since the purchase or sale of warrants combined with delta-neutral hedging led to a portfolio with very little risk, it seemed very plausible to me that the risk-free assumption would lead to the correct formula. The result was an equation that was equivalent to the future Black-Scholes formula. I started using this formula in 1967.
Did you apply your formula, that is the future Black-Scholes formula, to identify overpriced warrants and then delta hedge those positions?
I didn't have enough money to have a diversified warrant portfolio and to also place the hedge, since each side of a hedge position requires separate margin. I used the formula to identify the most extremely overpriced warrants. I found warrants that were selling at 2 or 3 times what my formula said they should be priced at. So I just went naked, short warrants.
Selling warrants without a hedge seems to be in total contradiction to your desire to minimize risk. What if the market had a large rally?
That is exactly what happened. In 1967 to 1968, there was a large bull market. Small-cap stocks were up 84% in 1967 and 36% in 1968. It was a terrible time to have net short exposure. However, the formula was good enough and the warrants were so overpriced that I still broke even on the naked short positions. The formula really proved itself under the most adverse circumstances. As far as I know, the short warrant positions I implemented during 1967 to 1968 were the first actual application of the Black-Scholes formula in the markets.
When did Black-Scholes publish their formula?
I believe they discovered it in 1969 and published it in 1972 or 1973.
Did you consider publishing your formula?
The option pricing formula seemed to me to be a big edge on everybody else, so I was happy just to use it. By 1969, I had started my first hedge fund, Princeton Newport Partners, and I thought that if I published the formula, I would lose the edge that was helping my investors. I thought the best thing would be to keep quiet and just keep using it. It was like having a card counting system but not writing a book about it. Once Black and Scholes published their formula, it was too late. I don't have any regrets.
I believe that convertible bond arbitrage was probably the core strategy used by Princeton Newport Partners. Did you come up with innovations to the strategy that you can talk about now?
A convertible bond is a corporate bond that holders can convert into a fixed number of shares at a specified price. In effect, a convertible bond is a combination of a corporate bond and a call option. Because the embedded option has monetary value, convertible bonds will pay lower interest rates than corporate bonds. Convertible arbitrage funds will typically buy convertible bonds and hedge by shorting sufficient stock to neutralize the long exposure implied by the embedded call option, an activity called delta hedging. Originally, the embedded optionality in convertible bonds tended to be underpriced, and convertible arbitrage funds could earn substantial profits by buying underpriced convertible bonds and hedging the market risk with short stock positions. While the core strategy remained unchanged, increased competition drove down mispricings and made the sophistication of the convertible bond pricing model more important. In the simple convertible bond pricing model, a convertible bond is treated like a corporate bond with a warrant attached. The corporate bond is assumed to provide a floor to how low the convertible price can go. So if you have a 5% B-grade convertible bond, the assumption is that the price will never be less than a 5% non-convertible B-grade bond. We learned that if the stock price fell sufficiently far, then the grade of the bond would also fall, and consequently, the assumed price floor was not a floor. We were able to build that characteristic into the model and get a much more accurate convertible bond pricing model as a result. Our model also analyzed the entire family of related instruments to the underlying stock, which included convertible bonds, options, warrants, and convertible preferreds to find optimal hedge combinations across all these related instruments. After Princeton Newport Partners closed, I called up Fisher Black because I thought we had a better convertible bond model than anyone else and wanted to see if I could sell it to Goldman Sachs. Fisher Black flew out and spent 3 days reviewing our model. He agreed that it looked very good, but the problem was that the coding of the model was tailored to the digital equipment computers we used, which meant they would have had to recode the program to run it on their equipment. So he ended up not buying it. The following 2 or 3 years, he built his own convertible bond model. I don't know whether he used any of our ideas, but it really doesn't matter. How important was determining the optimal bet size in your trading success? How and why did you decide to use the Kelly criterion as the method for determining bet size? The Kelly criterion is the fraction of capital to wager to maximize compounded growth of capital. Even when there is an edge, beyond some threshold, larger bets will result in lower compounded return because of the adverse impact of volatility. The Kelly criterion defines this threshold. The Kelly criterion indicates that the fraction that should be wagered to maximize compounded return over the long run equals F equals PW minus PL over W, where F equals Kelly criterion fraction of capital to bet. W equals dollars won per dollar wagered, i.e. win size divided by loss size. PW equals probability of winning. PL equals probability of losing. When win size and loss size are equal, the formula reduces to F equals PW minus PL. For example, if a trader loses $1,000 on losing trades and gains $1,000 on winning trades, and 60% of all trades are winning trades, the Kelly criterion indicates an optimal trade size equal to 20%, 0.60 minus 0.40 equals 0.20. As another example, if a trader wins $2,000 on winning trades and loses $1,000 on losing trades, and the probability of winning and losing are both equal to 50%, the Kelly criterion indicates an optimal trade size equal to 25% of capital, 0.50 minus 0.50 over 2 equals 0.25. Proportional overbetting is more harmful than underbetting. For example, betting half the Kelly criterion will reduce compounded return by 25%, while betting double the Kelly criterion will eliminate 100% of the gain. Betting more than double the Kelly criterion will result in an expected negative compound return, regardless of the edge on any individual bet. The Kelly criterion implicitly assumes that there is no minimum bet size. This assumption prevents the possibility of total loss. If there is a minimum trade size, as is the case in most practical investment and trading situations, then ruin is possible if the amount falls below the minimum possible bet size.
I learned about the Kelly Criterion from Claude Shannon back at MIT.
Shannon had worked with Kelly at Bell Labs. I guess Shannon was the leading light at Bell Labs, and Kelly was perhaps the second most significant scientist there. When Kelly wrote his paper in 1956, Shannon refereed it. When I told Shannon about my blackjack betting systems, he told me to look at Kelly's paper in deciding how much to bet, because in favorable situations, you will want to bet more than in unfavorable situations. I read the Kelly paper, and it made a lot of sense to me. The Kelly criterion of what fraction of your capital to bet seemed like the best strategy over the long run. When I say long run, a week playing blackjack in Vegas may not sound very long, but long run refers to the number of bets that are placed, and I would be placing thousands of bets in a week. I would get to the long run pretty fast in a casino. In the stock market, it's not the same thing. A year of placing trades in the stock market will not be a long run. But there are situations in the stock market where you get to the long run pretty fast. For example, statistical arbitrage. In statistical arbitrage, you would place tens or hundreds of thousands of trades in a year. The Kelly criterion is the bet size that will produce the greatest expected growth rate in the long term. If you can calculate the probability of winning on each bet or trade and the ratio of the average win to average loss, then the Kelly criterion will give you the optimal fraction to bet so that your long-term growth rate is maximized. The Kelly criterion will give you a long-term growth trend. The percentage deviations around that trend will decline as the number of bets increases. It's like the law of large numbers. For example, if you flip a coin 10 times, the deviation from the expected value of 5 will, by definition, be small. It can't be more than 5. But in percentage terms, the deviations can be huge. If you flip a coin 1,000,000 times, the deviation in absolute terms will be much larger, but in percentage terms, it will be very small. The same thing happens with the Kelly criterion. In percentage terms, the results tend to converge on the long-term growth trend. If you use any other criterion to determine bet size, the long-term growth rate will be smaller than for the Kelly criterion. For betting in casinos, I choose the Kelly criterion because I wanted the highest long-term growth rate. There are, however, safer paths that have smaller drawdowns and a lower probability of ruin.
I understand that if you know your edge and it is precisely defined, which of course is not true in the markets, then the Kelly criterion is the amount you should bet to maximize the compounded return, and that betting either a smaller or larger fraction will give you a smaller return. But what I don't understand is that the Kelly criterion seems to give all the weight to the return side. The only way the Kelly criterion reflects volatility is through its impact on return. Besides the fact that people are uncomfortable with high volatility, there is the very practical consideration that your down and out point is not zero, as the Kelly criterion implicitly assumes, but rather your maximum tolerable drawdown. It seems to me that the criterion should be what maximizes growth, subject to the constraint of minimizing the risk of reaching your cutout point.
Suppose you have a bankroll of $1,000,000 and your maximum tolerable drawdown is $200,000. Then from the Kelly criterion perspective, you don't have $1,000,000 in capital, you have $200,000.
So, in your example, you still apply the Kelly criterion, but you apply it to $200,000. When you played blackjack, did you apply the Kelly criterion straightforward?
Yes, assuming I was sure the dealer was not cheating, because my objective was to make the most money in the least time.
What about when you managed the fund?
When I managed the fund, I wasn't forced to make a Kelly criterion decision. If you use hedges to theoretically neutralize your risk, then the Kelly criterion might well imply using leverage. In Princeton Newport Partners, where all positions were hedged, I found out that I couldn't leverage up my portfolio as much as the Kelly criterion said I should. Because the brokerage firms wouldn't give me that much borrowing power. Does that imply that you would have traded the Kelly Criterion if it was feasible in a practical sense? I probably wouldn't have, because if you bet half the Kelly amount, you get about 3/4 of the return with half the volatility. So it is much more comfortable to trade. I believe that betting half Kelly is psychologically much better. I think there is a more core reason why betting less than the Kelly amount would always be the rational decision in the case of trading. There is an important distinction between trading and playing a game such as blackjack. In blackjack, theoretically, you can know the precise probabilities, but in trading, the probability of winning is always an estimate, and often a very rough one. Moreover, the amount of extra gain foregone by betting less than the Kelly criterion is much smaller than the amount that would be lost by betting more than the Kelly criterion by the same percentage. Given the uncertainty of the probability of winning in trading combined with the inherent asymmetry in returns around the Kelly fraction, it would seem that the rational choice is to always bet less than the Kelly criterion, even if you can handle the volatility. In addition, there is the argument that for virtually any investor, the marginal utility of an extra gain is smaller than the marginal utility of an equal percentage loss. That's true. Say I am playing casino blackjack and I know what the odds are. Do I bet full Kelly? Probably not quite. Why? Because sometimes the dealer will cheat me, so the probabilities are a little different from what I calculated because there may be something else going on in the game that is outside my calculations. Now go to Wall Street. We are not able to calculate exact probabilities in the first place. In addition, there are things that are going on that are not part of one's knowledge at the time that affect the probabilities. So you need to scale back a certain extent because overbetting is really punishing. You get both a lower growth rate and much higher variability. Therefore, something like half Kelly is probably a prudent starting point. Then you might increase from there if you are more certain about the probabilities and decrease if you are less sure about the probabilities. In practice, did you end up gravitating to half Kelly? I was never forced to make that decision because there were so many trade opportunities that I usually couldn't put on more than a moderate fraction of Kelly on any single trade. Once in a while, there would be an exceptional situation, and I would hit it pretty hard. One good example was AT&T and the Baby Bells. Old AT&T stock was going to be exchanged for the new stock plus stock in the 7 Baby Bells. You could buy the old AT&T and short the new AT&T when issued and lock a price spread of about 3/4%. How large did you put on that trade? 5 million shares, which was equal to $330 million. It was the largest trade done on the New York Stock Exchange up until that point in time. What was your capital base at the time? Around 70 million. How did you determine what size to put on? That was all we could get. I assume you did the trade that large because it was the proverbial risk-free trade. That's the way it looked, but to be clear, there are no zero-risk trades. Do you want to expound? There was some remote possibility that we overlooked something. There is always the possibility that there is some unknown factor. How did you first get involved in statistical arbitrage? In 1979, we launched a research effort that I called the Indicators Project. We looked for indicators that might have some forecasting power, items such as earnings surprises, dividend payout rates, and book-to-price. We had a list of about 30 or 40 of these indicators that we investigated. As part of this project, one of the researchers looked at stocks that were most up and stocks that were most down during the recent past. He found that the stocks that were most up tended to underperform the market in the next period, while the stocks that were most down tended to outperform the market. That finding led to a strategy of buying a diversified portfolio of the most down stocks and selling a diversified portfolio of the most up stocks. We call that strategy MUD for most up, most down. My friend UCI mathematician William F. Donahue used to joke, little realizing how close he was to a deep truth, "Thorpe, my advice is to buy low and sell high." We found that this market-neutral strategy had about a 20% annual return before costs. It had fairly high risk because the two sides did not track as closely as we would have liked. There were two issues. One was to get the risk down, and the other was to get the transaction costs down. We felt we could get the cost down and that the risk wouldn't be a problem because the strategy would be part of a much larger portfolio. So it seemed like a viable strategy.
You settled on using the most up and most down stocks as the most effective indicators, but I'm curious as to whether any of the other indicators you tested also showed efficacy.
They did. For that period of time, we found a very marked pattern for stocks, depending on whether or not they paid dividends. Stocks that paid no dividends seemed to have above normal returns. Stocks that paid low dividends had below normal returns, but as the dividend payout went up, the total return tended to increase as well. There was effectively a U-shaped curve that favored buying stocks with no dividends and high dividends and selling stock with low dividends. Earnings surprises also seemed to have an impact for a considerable period of time, weeks and even months, suggesting the market was slow to assimilate this type of information. These were not all original discoveries. We combed the literature and tried to stay current in the network of people conducting this type of research, combining the research available from other sources with our own original ideas gave us a fairly long list of indicators that seemed to have an edge. But Princeton Newport was doing so well on a risk-adjusted basis with the strategies it had already that we put the statistical arbitrage strategy aside. It wasn't clear that the marginal improvement that could have been obtained by adding statistical arbitrage to the existing strategies warranted diverting the resources that would have been needed for its implementation.
When did you turn back to it again? In 1985, we placed an ad in the Wall Street Journal looking for people who had reliable ideas that would produce provable excess returns. One of the calls we received in response to that ad was from Jerry Bamberger, who turned out to be the person who had discovered statistical arbitrage at Morgan Stanley. My recollection is that he developed the strategy around 1982 and was eventually shouldered aside by Nunzio Tartaglia, who was his immediate superior. Tartaglia had come in some time later and took over the strategy, so Bamberger was disaffected and left Morgan Stanley. He saw our ad and came out to Newport Beach for an interview. He was very secretive at first, but as soon as he started talking about his strategy, I realized it was the same statistical arbitrage approach we had come up with, except that he had added a dimension that significantly reduced the risk. The innovation that Bamberger had added via our own strategy was that he grouped the stocks by industry and set up long-short portfolios within each industry. By adding industry neutrality, he significantly reduced the risk of the strategy. When Bamberger explained his industry-neutral approach, was your immediate thought, "That's obvious, why didn't we think of that?" When Bamberger explained his portfolio structure, I said, "Yes, that's obvious." But I didn't say, "Why didn't we think of that?" Probably because we had put the project aside. I believe that if we had decided to include statistical arbitrage in our portfolio, we probably would have migrated to the sector-neutral approach rather quickly. After Bamberger told you what he was doing, where did it go from there? We created a joint venture that Bamberger ran from New York. We funded it, and he programmed it. I'm curious. You already essentially knew what Bamberger was telling you. And his innovation was one that you could have easily implemented and would likely have done on your own had you not put the statistical arbitrage project aside. So you really didn't need Bamberger. Given that, what was your motivation for entering into a profit-sharing agreement with him? It was almost like a franchise operation. He was very smart and very efficient. He got his own people together and ran his own shop. It was well worth paying him to do all this. We probably would have incurred similar costs doing it in-house. So it wasn't a matter of paying Bamberger for the idea, but rather the execution of the idea. Essentially, you felt here was somebody who clearly understood the concept and could implement an idea that you weren't using anyway.
Exactly. There were almost no administrative costs in working with him. He was also someone who was very honest and principled. In a series of articles Thorpe wrote about his experiences with statistical arbitrage, he provided the following character sketch of Bamberger. Jerry Bamberger was a tall, trim, Orthodox Jew with a very high IQ, an original way of looking at problems in finance, and a wry sense of humor. He spent several weeks working with us in Newport Beach. After a few days, I noticed that Jerry always brought a brown bag for lunch and always ate a tuna salad sandwich. I finally had to ask, "How often do you have a tuna salad sandwich for lunch?" Jerry said, "Every day for the last 6 years." He was a heavy smoker, and I'm extremely sensitive to tobacco smoke. We did not hire smokers nor allow smoking in our office, so part of our negotiation was about how to handle this. We respected each other and worked out a compromise that met each of our needs. Whenever Jerry needed a cigarette, he would step outside our ground floor garden office. How did the fund work out? It ran for a couple of years and did quite well, and then the returns started to decline. By that time, Bamberger had made a fair amount of money from the joint venture, and he decided to retire. At that point, I refocused on the strategy and decided there was a better way to do it, which could get the return back up again. My thought was to make the strategy factor neutral. We did a principal components analysis of the portfolio and tried to neutralize the principal factors. What specific factors did you end up neutralizing the portfolio against? In factor analysis, there are two different approaches. One is what I would call an economic factors analysis, in which you actually know what the factors are, such as equity index prices, oil prices, etc. The other approach is abstract factor analysis, where all you have are the returns for each security, and you process it with mathematical models and end up with a collection of abstract factors that don't necessarily coincide with economic factors. The abstract factors best describe the actual historical data you are using. What is this type of approach called where the factors aren't specific items, but rather mathematical constructs? I call it abstract factor analysis, and principal component analysis is another version of this approach. If you have a huge collection of data points, you can find these things called principal components, which are vectors in the data space that are perpendicular to each other, and they best describe the data. Is the perpendicularity the reason why multicollinearity is not a problem? Yes. In abstract factor analysis, you don't have that issue. But with economic factors, you can have factors that are closely related to each other. That sounds like it's a big advantage for using abstract factors over economic factors. Yes, I think it's the way to go. The abstract factors can often get identified with specific economic factors or linear combinations of those factors. For example, it always turns out that the biggest abstract factor, or equivalently the biggest principal component, is the stock market. But you actually don't need that information. It is only an interesting aside. You could be completely ignorant of the real world and still apply abstract factor analysis. That's right. We applied the factor neutrality approach, and the returns went up and risk went way down. What year did you make the change? We started researching this idea in 1986 because we saw the returns of Bamberger's approach beginning to decline. So you began working on this approach while Bamberger was still there? Yes, he left in 1987. Did you completely lose touch with Bamberger after he retired? Actually, in the mid-1990s, his wife contacted me and asked if I would write a recommendation for him for a law school application. I was happy to do it. As I understand, he did go to law school and get his degree, but I don't know what happened to him afterward. You took statistical arbitrage to the next level by applying factor analysis. Where did it go from there? There was a hiatus in running statistical arbitrage between the time Bamberger left and the factor analysis approach was implemented. The October 1987 crash occurred during that gap in trading, which is too bad because that was the single best period for the strategy up to that point. So we missed out on some really great returns. But we still had returns in the high 20s pretty consistently until 1989, when Princeton-Newport was wound down after the Princeton office ran into its well-chronicled legal troubles with Giuliani. Can we talk about that episode? How did your partnership with Regan, who ran the Princeton office, come about? In 1969, when I met him, Regan was a stockbroker who was looking to do something better than just being a broker. It occurred to him that hedging might be a good way to go, and that he should start a partnership to do it. He made a list of four candidates who might be potential partners in such a venture, and I was on that list. He conducted the search shortly after I co-authored Beat the Market with Kassoff, which received a fair amount of publicity. I was looking for someone to do the business and administrative side, so it seemed like a pretty good fit. He was doing the things I didn't want to do, and I was doing the things that he couldn't do. When did you first find out that the Princeton office was being investigated? I first heard about it when someone in our office got a call from a trader in the Princeton office saying that federal agents were spilling off the elevators and grabbing all the records. I found out later that Regan and others in the Princeton office knew something was going on as much as a year earlier because of information requests. So effectively you found out the day before the story ran in the newspapers?
Yes.
What was your reaction? I had no idea what the motivation for the raid was or what the government was trying to find. Regan never gave you any inkling of what was going on?
Not a peep.
Were you wrong about your assessment of Regan?
I think he evolved over time, and in later years he wasn't the same person I knew when we first formed our partnership. I think success slowly transformed him.
What was your response when you found out?
I negotiated with Regan and the other defendants of the Princeton office to contribute $2.5 million toward their defense, but to cap the partnership's liability to that amount. Their argument was that the partnership should pay the total defense bill, but my attitude was that if they were guilty, then the partnership shouldn't pay anything. So we settled on the $2.5 million number. That ended up being much less than the actual legal bill, which totaled over $12 million.
So you and Regan were in adversarial roles regarding this matter?
Yes, especially since I wasn't getting any information from those guys. They had circled the wagons.
How did the Princeton office operate under the circumstances?
It was difficult because they were distracted by all the legal stuff, but it was still limping along. Several months after the indictment, I met with Regan and told him, "I don't know what is going to happen here. I am willing to run the whole operation until this is all over. If you and the other defendants are willing to step down now, assuming you are acquitted, I will be happy to reinstate all of you at the same terms, and I will put that in writing if you like." But there was absolutely no response. It was like I was talking to a deaf man. I decided this was not the type of relationship I wanted to continue in. Partnership closed shortly afterward except for winding down the existing positions.
Did you think of restarting the fund on your own?
I didn't want to do all the stuff that was involved in running a hedge fund. That was why I got a partner to run the business side in the first place. I also wanted a little bit of time out.
What happened after Princeton-Newport Partners shut down?
I kept a small staff in the Newport Beach office. During 1990 and 1991, we primarily traded Japanese warrants, which was very profitable until the dealers began dramatically widening the spreads on us. The trades might have had a 30% profit potential, but the bid-ask spreads became so wide that the transaction costs were 15%, so we had to give it up as a strategy. Then I heard that statistical arbitrage was doing well, and one of my largest previous investors wanted me to resurrect it as an investable strategy. In 1992, we restarted the strategy. It only made about 5% or 6% in that first year, but we were encouraged because it seemed that there was no reason other than random fluctuation for the below-normal return that year.
How did the strategy perform in the intervening years after the closing of Princeton-Newport Partners when you weren't trading it?
The period between 1989, when we closed Princeton-Newport Partners, and August 1992,
when we restarted statistical arbitrage, would have been good. We happened to restart trading in a low spot for the strategy, but we stayed with it, and the performance got better and better. For the approximate 10 years we ran the program, returns before fees and leverage averaged 21% annualized, with a standard deviation of only 7%.
Why did you shut the program down in 2002 when it had such a strong return/risk track record?
There were a couple of reasons. First, returns seemed to be declining. I had no idea whether this trend was temporary or permanent, but I suspected it would continue because there was much more money chasing the same strategy than ever before. We could have attempted to continue innovating to stay ahead of the trend and keep returns up, but that would have meant a lot of thinking and effort on my part. At that point, I said to myself, life is getting shorter, it's time to do some other things. Another reason for shutting down the fund was that I had a couple of key employees who wanted a much larger share of the pie. An unreasonably large amount, I thought, so I said, that is too much, goodbye.
Did you ever again look at how the program was performing?
We did look at it a few years ago. It was running about 8% annualized, which is not too bad in a 2% world, but not good enough to make me want to go back and do it.
What was your involvement with David Shaw, who was another relatively early practitioner of statistical arbitrage?
In 1988, David Shaw had left Salomon and was looking for someone to fund him in a statistical arbitrage startup. I didn't know exactly what he wanted when he came out here, but we talked for about 6 hours, and it seemed that his strategy was redundant with ours. So we parted on friendly terms.
So it was basically a matter of you both realizing that you were working on the same thing, and there really wasn't a match.
That is exactly right.
What did you do after you shut down the Statistical Arbitrage Fund in 2002?
I managed my investments in other people's hedge funds.
Do you have any recommendations on investing in hedge funds?
I don't have any recommendations now because I have run low on hedge fund candidates.
Why is that?
20 years ago, I understood the details of the hedge fund world very well because I was running one myself, and I knew a lot of the players and methodologies. I had a pretty good idea of which hedge funds had an edge and which ones were just asset gatherers. Since then, there has been an explosion in the number of hedge funds and assets under management, trends that have been accompanied by the entry of many more mediocre players. The increase in assets under management also tended to lower the return per dollar invested, as more money chased similar strategies. Finding the good hedge funds also became more difficult, as there were much larger numbers of managers to wade through. Over the years, hedge funds began to shift from having edges to being asset gatherers. At the same time, the fees hedge funds charged increased. There was a time when a flat 20% profit incentive fee would do it. Then it became 20% incentive plus 1% management fee, and then 2% management fee. All of these trends made it more difficult for the investor to extract good returns from hedge funds.
Do you feel the hedge fund industry is following the path of the mutual fund industry, which became equivalent to the market, or actually worse than the market once you take into account transaction costs?
I believe the overall returns make hedge funds a less compelling investment than they once were.
Where do you see the steady-state equilibrium for the hedge fund industry?
It seems to me that the steady state would be when there is no excess risk-adjusted return in the hedge funds.
Wouldn't you expect there to be some excess return simply because hedge fund investors have to be compensated for accepting greater illiquidity?
I agree with that.
Where do you think we are now? Do hedge funds still have some premium in risk-adjusted returns versus other investments?
My instincts are that they still have an edge, but not by very much.
Do you still invest in hedge funds?
I haven't found new good ones to invest in for a while. If I did, though, I would happily invest.
So you are still invested in ones from earlier days?
Yes, but the number is diminishing as I decide some of these funds aren't as good as I thought they were, or their returns have declined. when you were actively searching for new hedge funds to invest in. With the number of hedge funds having grown so much, how did you decide which ones to look at?
I screened out funds that had an annualized standard deviation greater than 15%, or had an annualized return less than 12%, or had a bad year.
Were there any managers you met who were good at the markets through an intuitive sense rather than any explicit analytics?
I spent a day with Bruce Kovner many years ago, and I thought he had a good qualitative grasp of all kinds of interconnections in the markets. If you were a person who was able to think like Bruce Kovner, you could follow that path and be successful. I co-invested with Bruce on one of his ideas. Bruce bought an oil tanker and allowed a number of people he knew to invest alongside with him. I think I own 20 feet of this tanker. It was called the Empress de Mers, and at the time it was the largest oil tanker in the world. The tanker could be bought for a little above scrap value because there was a surplus of tankers at that time, and the older tankers were in mothballs. I think this tanker had a scrap value of about $4 million, and Bruce bought it for $6 million. We just sat on it. It was sort of like an option on the oil market. When activity picked up in the oil market, there was a huge demand for tankers, so our tanker got used over and over and made a lot of money. It was in service until only a few years ago when it became so obsolescent that it was sold off for scrap.
How did you meet Warren Buffett?
When I started managing accounts trading warrants when I was at UCI, I got a reputation around school. One of the people who heard about me was Ralph Gerard, who was dean of the graduate school. He happened to be an investor with Buffett Partners Limited, which was being closed down because Buffett felt that stocks were at crazy heights in 1968, and he didn't feel there was much more he could do. Gerard needed to find an alternative investment to place the money that he was getting back from Buffett. He introduced me to Buffett, and we all played bridge at Gerard's house a few times. I knew Buffett was a really smart person when I met him in 1968. I remember telling my wife that given his ability to analyze companies, his rate of compounding, and the scalability of the approach, I thought he would be the richest person in the U.S. someday. He was, for a period, a few decades later, and from time to time thereafter. I lost track of Buffett, and then one day in 1982, I learned that Berkshire Hathaway, the company whose stock he had been distributing in 1968, had been turned into his own private mutual fund. I immediately realized what that meant. So I went out and bought Berkshire Hathaway shares. They had been selling for $12 a share in 1964, and here I was buying them at $985 a share.
Do you have thoughts on futures trend following as a strategy?
I believe there are versions of it that have a sharp ratio of about 1.0 or more, but that is low enough so that there is still a significant risk of getting shaken out of the strategy.
I take it then that you believe that there are trends inherent in the markets.
Yes. 10 years ago, I wouldn't have believed it, but a few years ago, I spent a fair amount of time looking at the strategy. My conclusion was that it works, but that it was risky enough so that it was hard to stay with it.
Did you ever use trend following as a strategy?
I did.
When did you trade futures?
We began the research project in 2006 and launched the trading program in late 2007. It was promising, and we were thinking of bringing it up large scale with institutional money. But in early 2010, my wife was diagnosed with brain cancer and my heart wasn't in it. Life is too short. I didn't want to launch another major activity. So we gradually wound down the program.
So the program had worked well while you're using it?
Reasonably well. It wasn't as compelling as the Princeton-Newport strategies or statistical arbitrage, but it would have been a good product, and it seemed to be better than most of the other trend-following programs out there that were managing a lot of money.
What kind of sharp ratio was your program running?
It was a little better than 1.0 annualized.
Since you are no longer using the strategy, can you talk about what modifications you made to improve a plain vanilla trend-following approach? Was there something about your program that made it different from other trend-following approaches and that might explain why it did somewhat better?
We combined technical and fundamental information.
What kind of fundamental information? The fundamental factors we took into account varied with the market sector. In metal and agricultural markets, the spread structure, whether a market is in backwardation or contango, can be important, as can the amount in storage relative to storage capacity. In markets like currencies, however, those types of factors are irrelevant. Would it be accurate to describe your approach as combining technical trend-following rules with market-specific fundamental filters that define favorable and unfavorable environments? Yes. Were there other enhancements you made to the standard trend-following approach? We had some risk-reducing approaches built into the system. We tracked a correlation matrix that was used to reduce exposures in correlated markets. If two markets were highly correlated and the technical system went long one and short the other, that was great. But if it wanted to go long both or short both, we would take a smaller position in each. Since correlations between markets change so radically over time, even changing sign, how long of a loopback period did you use? We found that 60 days was about best. If you use too short of a window, you get a lot of noise. If you use too long of a window, you get a lot of old information that isn't relevant. What other risk-reducing strategies did you incorporate into the system? We also had a risk management process that worked a bit like the old portfolio insurance strategy. If we lost 5%, we would shrink our positions. If we lost another few percent, we would shrink our positions more. The program would therefore gradually shut itself down as we got deeper in the hole, and then it had to earn its way out. We would wait for a threshold point between a 5% and 10% drawdown before beginning to reduce our positions, and then we would incrementally reduce our position with each additional 1% drawdown. At what drawdown point would your position be reduced to zero? 20%. How far down did you get? Our maximum drawdown was about 14% to 15%, by which point we were trading only about one-third of our normal base position size. How would you get restarted if the drawdown reached 20%? You wouldn't. You'd have to decide ahead of time how much of a drawdown would imply that the system is not as good as you thought it was and therefore shouldn't be traded. In hindsight, do you think reducing your exposure on drawdowns was a good idea? It all depends on how confident you are about your edge. If you have a really strong conviction about your edge, then the best thing to do is to sit there and take your lumps. If, however, you believe that there is a reasonable chance that you might not have an edge, then you better have a safety mechanism that constrains your losses on drawdowns. My view on trend following was that I could never be sure that I had an edge, so I wanted a safety mechanism. Whereas for a strategy like convertible arbitrage, I had a high degree of confidence as to the payoff probabilities, so reducing exposure on drawdowns was unnecessary. In a strategy like trend following where you couldn't accurately assess the probabilities, as you could in a strategy such as convertible arbitrage, what percent of the Kelly criterion was your bet size? We didn't use the Kelly criterion at all in trend following because the bet size was such a small fraction of Kelly that it didn't make any difference. I would guess that we were probably using something equivalent to 1/10 or 1/20 of Kelly. I understand that you looked at Madoff at an early point in his career. Can you tell me about that experience? Back in 1991, one of the major institutional investors in the Princeton Newport Fund asked me to review their allocation process for their pension fund. I spent several days at their offices reviewing their hedge fund managers. One of these managers was remarkable in that he printed positive returns of about 1% to 2% virtually every month. They had been invested with this manager for a few years. I asked them to show me the statements. I looked at the statements and very quickly determined that the manager was a fraud. How did you reach that conclusion? The first step was to look at what the manager said he did. His purported strategy was to buy a stock, buy a put a little below the stock price, and sell a call a little bit above the stock price. The premium he received for the call approximately balanced the premium he paid for the put. Buying the put protected him from losing much in any given month, but it certainly didn't mean that he would win every month. Suppose you have a month with a strong upmarket. He will do well because he will make the difference between the strike price of the call and the price at which he bought the stock. On the other hand, suppose you have a significant down month. Then he will lose because the puts he bought will get exercised at lower prices than where he bought the stock. Since he was doing the same strategy in all the stocks, he shouldn't be getting much diversification in months where most stocks were up or down. So he should have some very good months, but he should also have some very bad months. But those results were not showing up. His returns were not consistent with the market given the strategy he claimed to employ. So the immediate question I had was, why not? When I looked at the record, I noticed that miraculous trades would be put on periodically that would get rid of the potential losing months and make them winners, and get rid of the big winning months and make them moderate winners. And those miraculous trades were long or short S&P futures positions that just happened to come in the right month and the right amount to smooth everything out. After this initial review, I asked my client, "When do you receive your trade confirmation statements?" "Well," he answered, "they come in bundles every few weeks." "Who is the accountant?" I asked. "He is a friend of Madoff," they said. "He runs a one-man shop and has been Madoff's accountant since the 1960s. I held my nose and asked, "Who is in charge of information technology?" "Oh, his brother, Peter Madoff," they answered. I told him that I wanted to go over and check out the operation. They called up to arrange for my visit. Bernie was away in Europe, raising more money, as it turned out. His brother Peter said, "There is no way I will let him in the front door." I asked them to ask why, but Peter wouldn't give a reason. To me, the whole thing smelled. I told my institutional client that I wanted to take their daily confirmations and monthly statements and analyze them in more detail. "Fine," they said, "do the analysis and report back to us." I brought boxes of the confirmations and statements back with me to California and went over the information carefully. We looked at the individual trade confirmations and determined that most of the trades could never have been made. We chose to focus on the option trades because the stock trades were too difficult to prove false. Half the option trades were for options that didn't even trade on the transaction date. Zero volume. About a quarter of the rest couldn't have traded at the prices quoted. For the remaining quarter, we couldn't tell if the trades occurred. I took 10 of these trades to a high place brokerage friend and asked him if he could find out who the counterparties were on those trades. He checked and found out that Madoff's organization didn't appear as counterparty on any of the trades. I told my institutional client, "He is printing fake trades. He is making it all up. What you should do is get out as soon as you can and as quietly as you can. This is a huge Ponzi scheme that will get bigger and bigger, and one day it is going to self-destruct." Did they get out?
They did.
Did you take it any further?
I thought of trying to expose it, but I had already had a bellyful of government with Giuliani and Princeton Newport Partners. I also had previously found some small frauds and was told by a lawyer friend of mine who spent 8 years working for the SEC that it would be a waste of time reporting it.
Why is that?
Because they didn't care about stuff like that.
What are your thoughts on the efficient market hypothesis?
Based on our daily success in Princeton Newport Partners, the question wasn't, is the market efficient, but rather the appropriate questions were, how inefficient is the market and how can we exploit the inefficiencies? The claim of market efficiency, which implies that no market edge is possible, is a hollow statement because you can't prove a negative. But you can disprove market efficiency if there are people who have a demonstrable edge. There is a market inefficiency if there is a participant who can generate excess risk-adjusted returns that can be logically explained in a way that is difficult to rebut. Convertible arbitrage is a good example. You can lay out exactly how it works, why it works, and approximately how much return you expect to get.
How would you summarize your philosophy of the markets after all these years?
I think inefficiencies are there for the finding, but they are fairly hard to find.
Do you think it has gotten harder to find inefficiencies, given the increased competition?
It has gotten harder for me. but that may only be because I am older and less interested and have more money, which makes me less motivated.
Do you have any advice for someone who wanted to pursue the markets as a challenge?
The approach that worked for me was the title of a book written much later by my ex-sister-in-law, Do What You Love and the Money Will Follow.
Anything else?
Try to figure out what your skill set is and apply that to the markets. If you are really good at accounting, you might be good as a value investor. If you are strong in computers and math, you might do best with a quantitative approach.
Gambling and investing may not sound like they have much in common, but to Thorpe they were quite similar. They were both probability-based games for which the problem of finding an edge could be solved analytically, even though such a solution was widely assumed not to exist for either. Thorpe defied the standard preconceptions in both gambling and investing and applied the same type of scientific thinking and mathematical reasoning to each of these endeavors. It is therefore not surprising that the same principles and risk management he employed in gambling are as pertinent to providing trading lessons as those he used in the markets. Beating roulette was once considered a mathematical impossibility. By approaching the problem in a completely different way, focusing on predicting the most likely termination zone for the ball, Thorpe was able to create a giant 44% edge. The broad lesson is that sometimes what seems impossible is entirely possible if approached from a completely different perspective. A similar condition might apply to trading. If one grants that the markets can't be beat with conventional approaches, it by no means implies that unconventional approaches would have the same limitation. Thorpe's insight into how to improve the odds in blackjack betting via the basic system, that is, correct probabilistic decisions on when to hit, hold, split, or double up, was to vary the bet size. By betting more on high probability hands than on low probability hands, Thorpe was able to transform a losing game, even when played with perfect decisions other than bet size, into a game with a significant positive edge. There is an important analogy here that applies to traders. Varying the position size can be as important as the entry methodology. Trading smaller, or not at all, for lower probability trades and larger for higher probability trades can transform a losing strategy into a winning one. Thorpe had to bet something on even low probability blackjack hands, but the trader can forego lower probability trades altogether. Although in trading, probabilities cannot be accurately assessed, as they can in blackjack, traders can often still differentiate between higher and lower probability opportunities. For the quantitative trader, such an assessment might be based on a statistical analysis of past results for different strategies. As for discretionary traders, many of them have strong differences in confidence level for different trades. If a trader does better on high confidence trades, then the degree of confidence can serve as proxy for probability of winning. The implication then becomes to trade larger on high confidence trades and smaller, or not at all, on low confidence trades. The degree of confidence in a trade is relevant not only in determining the trade size, but also in deciding on the appropriate risk management approach. When Thorpe did arbitrage trades, where the maximum theoretical risk could be approximately estimated, he did not consider reducing exposure if the position went against him. In contrast, when Thorpe employed a trend-following strategy, in which the trades were directional and the edge far more uncertain than the edge in the various arbitrage strategies he had previously used, he made exposure reduction on drawdowns part of the methodology. A lesson that Thorpe learned in gambling was, don't bet more than you are comfortable with. Just take your time until you're ready. He drove his original blackjack backers crazy by starting out betting $1 on the bad hands and a maximum of $10 on the good hands, ridiculously small wagers given his edge and the objectives of his backers. Thorpe's perspective on risk and comfort level provides sound advice for traders as well. Emotions are deadly for trading, and the surest way to guarantee that emotions will impact trading decisions is by trading beyond one's comfort level. Many traders mistakenly believe that there is some single solution to defining market behavior. If only they could find that solution, trading would become like operating a money machine. Many traders are continually searching for this holy grail of trading methods. The reality is that there is no single solution to the markets, and any solutions that do exist are continually changing. Successful traders adapt to changing market conditions.
Even when they find patterns or methods that provide a market edge, they will change their approach as dictated by the market. Finding success in the markets is a dynamic rather than static process. Thorpe's approach to statistical arbitrage is a case study in adapting to markets. The initial concept was to balance long